want to thank everyone for tuning in to listen to this radio program. My name is Ian Castle. I'm a full-time microcap investor and founder of Microcap Club. And alongside me today is fellow full-time microcap investor Mike Schellinger, also known as Mike DD King. Mike, how are you doing today?
Great.
Well, it's good to have you back on the radio program again. A little over a month ago, Mike and I did a program called So You Want to Be a Full-Time Microcap Investor. And we addressed several topics such as, you know, how much capital is needed to become a full-time investor, position sizing, when do we sell, evaluating management, topics like this. And I would encourage anyone that's listening today that didn't to go back and listen to that first radio program that we did. And we had over 2,000 listens of that radio program. And I know both Mike and I were blown away by the response, and so much so that we decided to do a part two. We asked a question out to Twitter, what questions that people had for Mike and I. And so today's program is really a compilation of those questions that we received this week from you folks. So, you know, without further ado, you know, on the Microcap Club members forum, we were talking about target returns and some other subjects. And a topic that came out of this, as well as a question that was asked through Twitter, was, you know, Mike, how has your investing strategy changed as your capital base has grown?
Well, I don't think it's changed tremendously, but certainly there are a few things that have changed. So, you know, when I first started out, you know, I didn't have a lot of capital. And, you know, so I could invest in, you know, 3, 4, 5 different companies. And that was, you know, that was like the right number of companies at that point in time. But as the capital base grew, you know, the number of investments required to deploy that capital got bigger just because, you know, some of the companies I was investing in, it was really hard to buy, you know, enough to fill the portfolio. And also as I became a you know, a full-time investor, didn't have the, you know, the salary of you know, a job to back me up. I also, you know, probably got a little bit more conservative and wanted to spread it a little, you know, out a little bit further, you know, just because, you know, had to manage my risk a little differently. So those are kind of a couple things. I think another thing is that I've gotten, you know, a little bit more stringent in my requirements for investments. One thing is that, you know, earlier on I was happy to invest in a company where I thought there was 50% upside. And now I, you know, rarely will touch a company unless I think there's at least 100% upside. And, you know, some of that is just, you know, because it's, you know, hard to get in and out of a company. So if I'm going to, you know, try to invest in one, you know, especially with a larger amount of capital, you know, need to account for that. And also just because of the time involved, when you have a, you know, significant number of different companies you're investing in, you don't have time to research everything. So you got to kind of, you know, think about, you know, is your time, you know, is it worth investing your time in this company or not? So how about you?
Well, you know, I think you made a couple good points there, and you know, getting back to the fact that you kind of are only looking at companies that have 100% upside. You know, I kind of view that sort of as a sort of a margin of safety, if you want to put it that way. My strategy kind of changed, kind of similar to yours, maybe to a lesser extent on becoming a little more diversified because I'm a rather concentrated investor. I would say the biggest thing for me that's changed as my capital base has grown is really just how I buy into a company. And, you know, I think the type of company that I look for hasn't changed much through the years. You know, I'm investing in sort of the bottom 10% of the microcap space. So if the microcap space is anything below $300 million, I'm primarily looking at initially investing in things that are sub $30 million. And so, you know, a lot of these companies only trade $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000 worth of stock a day. And so, you know, the difference between buying $5,000 position versus a $200,000 position, it just means it takes you longer to buy that position. And so that's probably been the biggest thing it's changed is, you know, it just takes longer to buy the position. And I don't think too much will change for me in the future until I reach a certain threshold to where, you know, it just becomes problematic to be able to try to buy $500,000 or $1 million in a market that only trades $5,000 or $10,000 a day. And at that point, you're kind of forced to look at situations to perhaps do a private placement into the companies to get a full position, which adds a bit of complexity to it. But I think it's something that can still be done well and profitably. So I would say probably the biggest thing is just it just takes longer to buy a position as the capital base grows for me. So the next question that we had from investors is, when you're fully invested, how do you react to a good short-term opportunity?
Well, I would say a couple things. First of all, with my strategy, I always have cash, so at some level, so being fully invested is kind of a, where I couldn't, I didn't have any capital is a very rare event for me. That's kind of one aspect of it. But, I think when you're looking at, maybe another part of the question is when you're looking at a short-term opportunity, I think you have to ask yourself a couple things. What is the time value of money kind of, if it's something that's, 2 months long and it's, 20% upside, you have to look at, what's the risk reward, how much time are you going to have to invest in it? Is it worth your time? So those are factors that you'd have to consider. And then, if this has been pretty rare for me, but if I had to sell something to buy something else, then you have to also look at, well, is it actually, is the new thing that I'm buying, significantly enough better than the thing that I'm selling to make this worthwhile? So those are just a few things I would think about. What about you, Ian?
Well, my strategy is a little bit different than yours, Mike. I'm primarily only investing in my, top five or six highest conviction names. And, I spend most of my time just making sure I know those companies better than most people. And so I rarely take advantage of short-term opportunities or even look for them, with my investment strategy, just kind of how I explained it. I used to kind of look for trades of, maybe 2 or 3 month trade or even a couple day trade. But after a while, it became too much of a distraction, to be quite honest. And I felt if I could instead just devote that extra time that I was looking for shorter term situations, if I could spend that time just knowing my positions better that I already own, that it would probably be more productive and profitable in the end. And so, really for me, I don't really pay attention to too many short term opportunities. The next question we had, Mike, is you kind of hit on a little bit previously, but how often do you sell to cover your expenses? And do you have, I guess the other way of saying it is, do you have other investments that provide an income stream to you?
Well, I don't have other investments that that provide an income stream to me. I'm not really much of a dividend investor. So, to the extent, and sometimes there's companies I own that have dividends, but they're never would be of the magnitude that, all my dividend payments would be enough to cover my expenses. So, I carry a pretty good sized cash cushion. So it's probably been very rare that I've had to sell to cover my expenses. But, I think that's more a function of kind of my strategy than maybe what is typical for, other full-time investors that maybe deploy different strategies.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, for me, I sort of reap what I sow. And so the short version is I do normally have to sell stocks to pay bills. And that's not like it's on a monthly basis. I might take enough off the table at some point to have 6 months worth of cash sitting there where I don't have to do it on a monthly basis. But, I think in the first part of this radio series, we talked about this a little bit more. And this is perhaps the toughest part of being a full-time investor is having to sell stocks sell your positions to pay the bills. It's a mental hurdle. It's quite a mental hurdle, especially for somebody like me that looks to take a position for, multiple years, having to sell a stock every month, even though you're trying to keep that long-term focus is daunting. I do have some outside investments that produce an income stream, but kind of similar to what Mike's point was, it's not enough right now to cover all of my expenses, but it is an area that I'm interested in, as I have a couple of big wins, putting some capital aside into some areas that would take some of that stress off my investing would be a good thing. I think I even wrote a blog post about it last year called "Protecting Yourself from Yourself." And so, if people want to read that, I'd point you in that direction. Mike, what's your average hold time?
Well, I guess I've never actually gone out and measured it, but I would say it's less than a year. But having said that, you know, I may hold a stock for as short as a day, or for as long as, you know, years. Now, if I'm holding it for a day, you know, it's generally something that I already knew, and you know, there was an opportunity that popped up, and you know, usually based on a catalyst, and I buy it at the catalyst, and sell it later. But I would say probably if I had to give a guess, I would say it's probably in the 9 month time period. Now, having said all that, I scale in and out of stocks when I buy and I sell. Generally, I'm not buying all of it in one day, although that can happen, and generally, I'm not selling it all in one day. So, that kind of impacts the holding time. So if a stock is in my portfolio for 2 years, that doesn't mean that, you know, at the two-year point, boom, I sold it all. It probably means I sold a little bit, along the way, probably bought in a closer period of time, but spread the buying out, you know, a little bit more. How about you?
You know, when I make it, I kind of hit on this in the last question, but when I make an investment, I'm usually looking to hold it for 3 to 5 years. Now, not every investment works out as planned, so it can end up being shorter than that in reality. But I'm really willing to hold an investment as long as the story doesn't change and management executes. You know, and obviously that the opportunity and the valuation is compelling. With every investment, my goal is to make 10x my money in 5 years from my initial buy. My hope is that, you know, I average up repeatedly. Some of my biggest winners are companies that I've just continuously averaged up on. You know, not surprisingly, when I look at my portfolio today, the stocks in my portfolio that I've held the longest are up the most, you know, which kind of makes sense if you think about that strategy.
Right.
But some people might ask, well, why would you ever sell it if you're up 10x? And usually one of the reasons I would sell also is, you know, when you're buying a microcap, usually after it goes up 10 or 20x, it's not a microcap anymore. They usually become more liquid. They're institutionally owned. And usually that means they just become more efficient. And so usually when I feel I lost my edge in a position, I'll end up taking some off the table or getting out of it as well. So that's another reason why I would sell something even after it's been working for so long.
All right. You know, another thing I would add is probably for me, my ideal hold time is actually, you know, multiple years as well. But sometimes you're buying a company, you see an opportunity that, you know, where there's a really good risk reward, and I'm often buying them early enough where, you know, I don't know, I have a good roadmap for how it's going to evolve, but I think the situation is really attractive. And like you said, if, you know, management keeps executing, those are the ones where, I'm going to hold them longer. And, you know, sometimes management doesn't execute, or sometimes the stock moves a lot, and I decide it's time to take the money off the table. So I think that, you know, the goal really is to get those long-term holds where you can find them. But, in the microcap space, that's a challenging endeavor.
It sure is. It's not easy. How do you buy into illiquid stocks?
Well, I think the answer to that kind of depends on the type of situation. So there's kind of two different types of situations that I would say. A lot of times I'm buying at an inflection point. So, you know, let's take, for example, you know, a company I've been following, tomorrow morning I walk in and they announce a big, large order. The stock might be really cheap, you know, relative, you know, at the current price based on that new piece of information. So I may jump in and buy most of that position on that day. You know, then there's another situation where, oh, maybe I find a company and it's, you know, interesting and I start building a position and, you know, there isn't that catalyst there that, you know, all of a sudden people are going to wake up and, ooh, this is a big opportunity. So there maybe I can take a little bit more time. So it kind of depends on the situation, and sometimes it's really quick and other times, you know, it's spread out further. You know, also, of course, is going to depend on liquidity and you know, and how the stock moves too. You know, when you get that catalyst situation, sometimes you just say, well, you know, the stock is 50 cents and I'm going to buy, you know, up to 70 cents and that's where I cut it off. So, you know, you keep going and it hits 70 cents, maybe moves to 80 cents and then you say you're done. Other situations, you know, the stock price is maybe a little bit more stable and you can, you know, kind of nibble at the stock over a longer period of time and, you know, gives you a little bit better chance to build a position. So, well, that's what I would say. How about you?
You know, actually, I got a follow-on question to that for you, Mike. So when you're okay. when you're buying your initial position, and you talked before about how, you know, you're looking for, I guess it obviously depends, it's a trade versus an investment, but, you know, for your investments, where do you buy up to when you're making that that initial investment? Do you kind of buy up to a point to where you know that it's at least going to be, if everything works out, 100% gainer? Is that kind of a threshold thing? Like, say, okay, it's a 50-cent stock, and you think this could be a $1.50 stock in a year. Well, I'm willing to buy it up to, you know, 75 cents because, you know, I think this is at least going to be a double.
Yeah, I don't know that it's that, you know, formulaic. I think it's kind of a gut feel thing. It might depend on how the stock trades. You know, sometimes, you know, sometimes what happens is it starts going up a bit, and all of a sudden there, you know, maybe people don't even know the news is out there, and you're able to buy, and then all of a sudden, you know, people find out the news, and there's, you know, all of a sudden there's no shares left to buy. You know, so kind of sometimes the market decides it for you a bit, you know, but yeah, it's probably not that formulaic. You know, sometimes it might also depend on what the liquidity is, what my confidence level is, and, you know, the understanding. Because,
right.
you know, when you're buying after a catalyst, you often don't have a whole lot of time to really analyze the situation. So, you know, it kind of depends on my confidence level.
Right. That makes sense. You know, for me, it's, you know, I try to buy as carefully as possible, and, you know, it can sometimes take weeks or even months to buy a large position in some of these illiquid companies. I think I've also written a couple of blog posts on this subject in particular, but sort of the short version is, you know, I normally buy more as my conviction grows. And all my winners, I was constantly averaging up. You know, unlike what most people will tell you on TV or the financial media, averaging up is a great thing to do. And with illiquid stocks, you know, with illiquid stocks in particular, you know, for me and my concentrated strategy, taking larger positions, the big thing is just to be sure that before you take a really big position, that you're sure you're going to be right. You know, really, as my conviction grows, and usually that last, I call it the last third, I normally don't care almost what I pay for it, and I'm usually paying up 200-300% higher than my first third that I purchased. And so all my big winners had that in common. I was always averaging up repeatedly.
Right. All right. Yeah, you know, I guess the other thing that kind of comes to mind, too, is, like, sometimes what will happen is when you're buying on a catalyst event, you know, you'll maybe buy, like, say, a third of your position right away just because, you know, the opportunity presents itself. And then sometimes after I do that, I'll sort of circle back and, like, okay, now I'll spend some time to, you know, really, really, really understand the company a lot better. And after doing that, you know, maybe increases my confidence level, or at least hopefully does. And if my confidence level is increased, then I might, you know, add on to that position. So we talked about buying. What about selling?
You know, one of the inherent laws of small price stocks, or especially these microcap stocks, is as their prices go up, so does the liquidity. So if you end up being right in a position, normally those, in most cases, normally those stocks become, you know, 5, 10, 100 times more liquid, you know, as they go up, you know, go up 5, 10x. And so if the question is, how do I sell an illiquid stock, that usually is another way of saying, you know, it's been a losing position for me, or it's been a loser. And so how do I sell my losers? My only edge in investing is knowing what I own better than most people. And this allows me to hold multi-baggers when they work. And it also lets you see things before the masses see them if you're attuned to what's going on in that company and the industry dynamics. You know, that's why I spend so much time doing maintenance due diligence into my core positions, is just to keep that edge. And so it gives me an edge not only in holding winners but also selling before the masses. Now, I still take a loss, obviously, but it can give me additional time, whether that's days or sometimes even weeks, to scale out of a position before a problem is apparent to the rest of the street.
So do you usually find yourself sort of scaling out of a position, or is it more of a kind of, one day you decide that, now is the time to exit, and you exit, relatively rapidly?
It really depends on the liquidity profile of it, and how bad a situation is. Sometimes,
right.
It's been a little while, knock on wood, since I had one of these circumstances. But if it's a really bad situation and it's worthwhile to sell down the position and hit the bid, so to speak, just because you just want to be out of it. You know, it's worthwhile taking the stock down 10% to get out because you think the downside's 50%, then it's worthwhile to do so. And a lot of times, with stocks, you can find liquidity at extremes. And so, if a stock's down, 15, 20%, you'll find liquidity somewhere. And so it really depends on how bad the situation is. If the situation's just not that bad, you can, based on liquidity, you can kind of get out of a position slowly but surely. But it really depends on how bad the situation is.
I would say for me, I like buying where I'm generally scaling in, although maybe not completely. I'm generally scaling out when I'm selling. So, I think we talked about this, I believe, in one of the other radio programs. So it's based on a number of factors, risk reward. I'm always kind of looking at a position too in terms of if what do I think the upside is from here, and what are the risks? And a lot of people like to think of it, and I think it's a good way to approach it, is you're thinking about, if I bought the stock today, would I buy it today? And if I wouldn't buy it today, then maybe I should be selling a bit.
Yep.
So, those are kind of some things. Position sizing is always something I'm thinking about. If something's gotten overweight, I might be, selling for that reason. But it's almost always a scale out, because I think that, unless something has drastically changed with a company, it's usually not kind of a black and white thing. It's kind of a, maybe this company isn't as attractive today as it was yesterday, because the stock price has moved up or something has changed. But, then there's the occasional event, which, usually is when you're wrong, when, today is the day to sell all, and you take your lumps and move on. And that's
right.
That's just part of the business. So, Ian, our next question is, what's the best approach for, building rapport with management? How would you, like to talk with management a lot. How would you answer that question?
Well, this is a great question, because I try to have a good relationship with all the management teams that I'm invested in. I think first and foremost, be prepared and do your homework on a company. Management always respects investors, large or small, when they do their homework and that ask good questions. I think Chip Maloney and I wrote a couple articles recently on interviewing management, on talking to management, on MicroCap Club, that addresses this topic. The other thing is, this might sound funny, but the other thing is just be nice. I found a lot of investors, excuse my language, but are just assholes when they talk to management. So always be nice. Management will never open up to you if they don't like you. In fact, they will probably not talk to you at all. So let me put it to you this way. As a human being, are you quick to respond to people that are complaining to you constantly? Of course not. So why would management teams want to respond to you when they know every time you call is to complain to them about something? I have some friends that manage funds and some larger investors that that are invested in some of the same companies I'm invested in, and management doesn't return their calls right away, but the management team always returns my calls, and this isn't some ego trip. I'm just saying this to prove a point. The biggest reason they pick up the phone when I call is I'm not an asshole. And I'm not always looking to complain to them every time I call. It's important to remember that, to inject a little humanity into your conversations with management teams. They're not robots. You know, I think it's important for you to provide value back to management teams as well. Also, don't forget to be complimentary, you know, and tell them when they're doing a great job. I made a whole speech about this at our last conference that we had last October. Make sure the relationship is two-dimensional, not just one. You know, give back to them in certain ways. You know, I have to be honest, though, the thing that gives me the most pride is my relationships with the management teams. As an example, one of the companies I'm invested in now, a company I invested in a few years ago initially, when it was just an idea on a napkin, just listed on the New York Stock Exchange. As a larger investor, I've helped the CEO navigate the capital markets, and the CEO has done, you know, an incredible job taking a company from an idea to being listed in about 4 years. I probably talked to him once or twice a week, every week for the last 4 years. You know, next month, that CEO will be ringing the closing bell on the New York Stock Exchange, and I will be standing beside him. And that right there is sort of what it's all about to me, you know, just because I'm usually building pretty strong relationships with management teams. But, you know, I'd love to hear your take, too.
Yeah. Well, I think you hit on a lot of great points. One thing, maybe a couple things I'd like to go back on. You know, you talked about sort of, you know, reading the filings, doing your homework. I think probably one of the top things you really have to be careful about with management is being respectful of their time. They're very busy. They, you know, especially in the microcap world, that, you know, you're often talking to the CEO, whose, you know, full-time job is to manage the company, and they also have to answer to stockholders. But, you know, they're wearing a lot of hats, and they don't have a lot of time. And if you're wasting their time by either, you know, asking questions you should have been able to find the answer to, or, you know, you're calling them every other day to ask them another question, they're going to shut down. But if, you know, if you're being respectful of your time, doing like what you do, Ian, and, you know, providing something back, then, you know, then it becomes a much better conversation, a much, you know, better situation. So that's one thing. I think the other thing that sort of touches on what you talked about a bit, and Chip also mentioned in his article, is, you know, when you start asking tough questions, and, you know, there's tough questions to be asked, but you got to be really careful about how you ask the question. So, you know, the example that Chip used is, you know, if a company just did a big stock option grant, just don't ask them, you know, why the heck did you, you know, do that excessive stock option grant? They're going to feel like they're being attacked. You know, rather ask them, you know, something along the lines of, you know, what criteria did the board use in rewarding management in the recent stock option plan? So it's just a whole different way of phrasing the question, and it doesn't feel like you're attacking management. Management doesn't want to feel attacked. You know, they're trying to do a job, and yeah, maybe not all companies are looking out for shareholders the best. But if you start out the question by sounding like you're attacking the company, they're going to clam up and they're not going to want to converse with you. So I think those are probably the two biggest things I would say, especially as far as building rapport.
No, I think those are some really good points. A lot of people forget, too, that these companies, especially these small microcaps, are hit on every day from somebody trying to sell them something, whether that's an investor relations, the countless investor relations firms that are out there, investment banks, attorneys, you name it. These people are bombarded every day with people just trying to sell them something from the service providers in the space. And so you really need to be cognizant of that and take advantage of the opportunity when you get it to talk to management and make a good impression. You know, and I think that's one of the key takeaways that Mike was trying to get across as well.
Absolutely.
Could you share your process about, you know, keeping your emotions out of your investment decisions?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, always a challenging area because, you know, we're all human and subject to emotions. So just a couple of things. So first of all, I think it's easier to think about that on the buying side than on the selling side. Before you've bought it, you can always make the decision to buy or not buy, but you're a little bit more emotionally attached to it on the selling side. So that's kind of, I would kind of look at it in those two different areas. One thing I would say is the old saying, remember that pigs get slaughtered. So you start getting too greedy and it's going to catch up with you. Another thing is, and I think this is probably the most important thing, is to keep the investment thesis in mind. Once you've bought a position, if when you bought it, the thesis is still there and it's held and maybe the stock has pulled back 10-20%, it's not really a reason to sell. These markets are dynamic. You're never going to hit the bottom all the time. So you've got to be prepared for that. I think the other thing, though, is when a stock moves against you, moves down that 10-20%, one of the first things I do is, maybe I go out and take a look and, revisit my evaluation because maybe I missed something. And it does happen. I try to do deep due diligence, but sometimes there's, something that I missed, or sometimes there's something, there's n new market news that's out there that maybe the company hasn't announced. Maybe there's some thing that has hit their industry, for example, that you didn't know about, but other people do know about. So sometimes you can look at that, stock price as a, sort of a kick to get you back going and taking a look at why you decided things and what information is maybe out there. So those are, those are just a few things I would think of. What about you?
Controlling your emotions is, it's probably 95% of investing, and it's what separates the great investors from the not so great ones. Controlling your emotions and also really controlling human nature, because what I found is human nature is almost the opposite of what you should do to be a profitable investor.
Right.
The unfortunate truth, though, is the only way to learn a lot of times, especially with the emotional stuff, is by experience. A lot of this stuff you can't read in a book or sit in a classroom and understand it. You kind of have to experience the emotional extremes of a lot of these things. Some of the things Mike just spoke about too. You can't expect to go out there and get it right the first time, and there's no easy path to this. You just have to go out there and experience a lot of these things for yourself. And so that's probably the only other thing I'd add on top of what you said, Mike.
Okay. Well, related to this, we also had another question. Talking about keeping emotions in check, people were asking about bear markets and how do you survive through a bear market? How do you invest through a bear market? And I think that really relates a lot to emotions, because if you're long a stock, that's, you're in for a beating. So I don't know, what do you think about bear markets?
Well, the main thing about bears is not to get bit or scratched. And so I think we said in the previous program that when I was going to be making a decision to go to becoming a full-time investor, I felt that I really needed to invest through a bear market before I made that switch. And this was important because you really don't know how good you are until you've invested through a bear market. I mean, when we look even today, the past 5 years, I mean, it's been a pretty good bull market. I would not to say that you should, if you're able to make that switch now, to do it. But I know for me, looking back, this was back in 2008. I really needed to invest through that. I needed to invest through that bear market before I had the confidence to go out really on my own. And so, what I've found is the types of companies that you invest in make a big difference. I gave an example of Zag, which was a big winner for me even during that economic backdrop that we had in 2008. That was a company that represented a very profitable, very high growth, small microcap company that had no institutional ownership. That company was up 200-300% while the market was down 40 or 50%. And really, I think if you're getting into a bear market, or you feel that you are, be really cognizant of the investments that you're in, and even who owns those investments that you're in. The quickest path to going broke is being invested in known companies that are institutionally held during a bear market. Just look at even at the Russell Microcap Index, which it's called the Microcap Index, but really the average market cap is 250-300 million. It's pretty big. And most of those companies are institutionally held. just look at even over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, maybe even over the last 6 months, when you have a short-term little blip down in the markets, the Russell gets killed. And that's because during those bear markets, or even during those little short downdrafts in the market, you know, these institutions want to reduce their exposure to risky, quote-unquote, investments, which microcaps are. And so that combined with people just pulling money out of microcap-focused funds, you know, this creates just a landslide of selling into relatively illiquid investments. And that's why institutionally owned microcaps do very, very poorly in bear markets. And so I'm trying to be as crystal clear as possible, but stay away from institutionally held microcaps. I'll throw it back to you, Mike.
Right. So, I'd add a number of different things. So, first thing is you need to have a longer-term view. Microcap businesses, quite frankly, tend to not be as sustainable as larger businesses. So, you know, if you're in a bear market, you need, you know, the company may perform well, but the stock price may not perform well. So you want to be invested in companies that are going to do well throughout the bear market, so that you can reap the reward, you know, when the bear market ends. Now there's rare exceptions to that will move up in a bear market, but you know, you might have companies that are performing great as a company, but the stock price isn't. So you got to kind of have that view. Another thing I've noticed a lot, particularly in the last bear market, is that spreads on stocks tend to widen, so selling is harder. So that's something you need to be cognizant of. Investing in businesses that aren't as cyclical is helpful, and that sort of ties into the long-term view. You know, if you're investing in a pharmaceutical company that's growing consistently, you know, people need to buy drugs. People still get sick when there's a bear market, but you know, they might decide not to go out to eat. So you got to be careful of you know, the type of industry that you're in, because some perform better than others. Be careful of debt. It's harder to raise money during a bear market. So companies that have lots of debt are prime candidates for big problems. Also, it's during a bear market, you know, a lot of times companies are going to swing from profitability to a loss. So if they've got a pretty big debt load, then it can be a challenge for them to make it through that period. Whereas if you have a company that's highly capitalized, got a strong balance sheet with money in the bank, they can survive that market. In fact, they can even be opportunistic because they might be able to buy another business in the down market is, for example, about to go bankrupt, and they can get it for a song and a dance because they're the only one that's left at the table that has money there. So, and I guess the last point is, like the companies that I was talking about that, have a strong balance sheet and have money in the bank, cash is king. You want to have cash that you can deploy, when you get to that point in the bear market where there's panic in the street, and you can buy things for cheap. So I think that's a really important thing to consider in a bear market, because while bear markets can be painful, the best investors figure out how to make money on the backside of it. And so in addition to protecting yourself as you're going through it, you also have to, you also want to be thinking about how you're going to reap the reward in that next bull market.
A lot of great points there, Mike. I think that's all the questions we have. Thanks, Mike, for joining us, and we look forward to doing this again at a later date.